Thanks, everybody, for gathering this afternoon for the second in this series of studies that we're having on parenting. I'll start out with a disclaimer and some housekeeping, so I'm not here to say that I've mastered any of this. And so along those lines, I encourage discussion, questions, comments, agreements, disagreements, whatever. Try to make this as interactive as possible. So I'll provide, you know, framework for the discussion and the study, but you know, there's others of us in here that have had plenty of experiences parenting and can add plenty of color and texture to the study, which will be good. So when I was first assigned this topic of loving our children, right, I thought, well, that seems pretty straightforward, right? All those in favor? We're done. We'll get on. So, but I figured we got about 45 minutes, so we need to think about this a little more deeply. And so I thought we'll break this down and think about what is love, you know, first of all, talk a little bit about that, and then what does loving our children look like? And what can we learn from what the scriptures say about that topic and apply in our own parenting for ourselves? And so in thinking about that, naturally I thought about God, right? God is love, God is our Father, and so clearly, we can look to God and we can look to the example that He sets forth for us and how He loves us, His children. And hopefully there are lessons then that we can draw from that and apply in a practical way and apply them to our own parenting. I don't think anything that we're going to be talking about this afternoon is surprising or new or different. These are things I think probably all of us are aware of and have thought about, perhaps taught, studied, talked about, you know, many times before. But it's always good to bring those things that are in the back of our minds to the forefront of our minds, think about them for a while, hopefully in an organized fashion, and, you know, learn from each other and benefit from that study. So to begin with, let's just turn over to 1 John chapter 4, and let's read a text there from John, talking about God. 1 John chapter 4 and starting in about verse 7. Familiar passage to all of us. This is all about the love of God. So John writes, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. The one who does not love does not know God, for God is love. By this the love of God was manifested in us, that God has sent His only begotten Son into the world so that we might live through Him. And this is love, not that we loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has beheld God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in us and His love is perfected in us. By this we know that we abide in Him and He in us, because He has given us of His Spirit. And we have beheld and bear witness that the Father has sent the Son to be the Savior of the world. Whoever confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God abides in Him and He in God. And we have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this love is perfected with us, that we may have confidence in the day of judgment, because as He is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. We love because He first loved us. If someone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar. For the one who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from Him, that the one who loves God should love his brother also." So again, a very familiar passage, very rich passage. And if we just focus in, you know, look back and focus in on a couple of passages to draw your attention to verse 7. "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God." And verse 16, "And we have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him." So what, you know, what are a couple of the things that we can observe from this passage about God. God and love. Okay. Can't separate the true, the two, that is. That's right. Okay. I think God, not a trick question, really. God is love. Okay. So we can...
is from God.
Okay.
Real love only comes from God.
Right. Okay. So God is the source of love. Really defines God, and God defines love. To your point, IVA, really cannot separate the two of those. So it's proper for us to look to God as our perfect example of what love is, and then apply, you know, those lessons. So what we're going to do is take a look at God and observe some things. I think about 6 points about God's loving His children, loving us, that we can observe from what we see in the Scriptures, and then hopefully apply those to our own parenting. So applications, we'll say, to parenting. All right. So when we first need to, I think, lay some definitional groundwork when we think about the notion of love, because it's clearly a word that is thrown around a lot in our vernacular, you know, our language, the way we use it in a lot of different ways. And so when we first consider loving our children, like I talked about earlier when I was first presented with the idea, okay, we'll talk about loving your children. Seems kind of intuitive, right? Seems natural. Part of the way that happens is because we think of love as a feeling or an emotion. But I think it's important, you know, in reading this passage from John and thinking about God and God's love, that this love that we are to have really towards everyone, but especially in this context we're talking about towards our children, it's an active verb, okay? It is an active pursuit that we have, and it is really to seek out and to do what is best for the other person. So clearly we saw that from 1 John the 4th chapter. God sought out and He did what He knew was best for us without regard to anything clearly that we had done or not done. So it's looking to do what is best for the other person. So we know that, you know, in the Old Testament there was a Hebrew word for love. In the New Testament, it's interesting, you know, we observe that when we study, there's about 3 different words that were used in the original language, the original text, for the that comes across in our English translations as the word love. So first, there's this word philanthropia, which should look and sound a little familiar at least. It's where we get our philanthropy word, and that really just in most translations, I think that it really comes across and is translated really just as kindness. And there's a couple of examples where we can look to see where it's used in that way over in the book of Acts. And maybe we'll just look at one example of this in the 28th chapter. In verse 2, so this is the account of when the Apostle Paul was shipwrecked on his way to Rome. Beginning of chapter 28, verse 1, and when they had been brought safely through, then we found out that the island was called Malta, and the natives showed us extraordinary kindness, for because of the rain, goes on to describe what the natives had done. So that word there actually is this word philanthropy, or however it's pronounced, and is kindness towards mankind in general, kindness towards people, and that's how it comes across and is rendered in, at least in our English language. It sometimes is love, but really it's the idea of kindness. Then there is this word that I think is probably what oftentimes we maybe normally think of when we think about loving something or loving someone. It's this word phileo. And, you know, that's more of a tender affection, is that idea. So we think about an example of this, you know, like cherishing something higher than other things, or people. And certainly this gets closer to the idea of having a feeling or having an emotion towards someone or something. So an example of this would be over in John chapter 20. And this is John chapter 20. This is after Jesus has risen from the dead. And in verse 2, John writes, "And so she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them," and the text goes on. So you think about that, well, you know, Jesus loved everybody, right? Jesus loved all the disciples. What's different about John? It's this word phileo that happens to be used here. And so the idea or the notion is that there was more of a, you know, there was this tender affection that Jesus had, as is recorded here, for or toward John, that you know, distinguishes in some way that relationship. Then there's the third word that we come across, which is this agape or agapeo, different roots. And this is more along the lines of you know, of what we had talked about earlier, which is a deliberate kind of choice to seek what is best for another. And so, you know, an example of this, so we think of like John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that who should ever believe in him should not perish, but should have everlasting life." So that is an example of where this word agape, or some form of it at least, is used in that translation. Or over in Romans the 5th chapter, where Paul writes about how that God loved us while we were sinners, and offered up Jesus, his Son, as a sacrifice for us. It's that same idea of taking a deliberate action, choosing to do something solely because it is best for the object of the love, the person who is the object of this love. So I think a couple of things to draw just from some of these definitions is that when we're talking about God's love for us, we're really talking about this third form here. So that text we read from John, the 4th chapter there, if you happen to look through an interlinear or something that shows what Greek words are used in certain contexts, this really is the word that's used in that regard. Not that the others are never used, but really we're talking about God's love for us in seeking what's best for us. It's this this notion here, this definition of this word here that's used. And what we learn from that, I think, is that this isn't something that is an impulse from feelings, and it's also not always necessarily a natural inclination, because again, this is a deliberate choice that we have made to love, in this case, our children. You know, the same idea is, of course, relevant to marriage relationship, loving your husband, loving your wife, seeking out what is best for the other person. And I think the other thing, too, is this can operate, and often does operate, independently from this. So this can happen regardless of, you know, how you feel about the other person. So where might be an example, maybe from the teachings of Jesus, in fact, where we're to have this in a case in which we might not necessarily, and most likely don't have this. Right, love your enemies, right? Probably not going to feel a whole lot of tender affection for our enemies. Nevertheless, we're commanded to have this kind of love, which is, you know, seeking out what is best for the other person. So, with that kind of definitional groundwork, we can begin to look at some of the things that God does as our Father, and I think learn lessons and draw from that and apply to our own parenting, understanding this about his character. So it has to begin. So first of all, loving is this deliberate choice. Seeking out and doing, providing what is best for the other person has to start with knowing what the other person's needs are. So clearly God knows our needs. In fact, he knows them better than we do. Let's look at a couple of passages over in the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew chapter 6. Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 6. Let's take a look just at a couple of verses here quickly. Verse 8. Therefore, do not be like them. Comparing, he's talking about the Gentiles here. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask Him. And then if we drop down to verse 32 in that same chapter, later on in the same discourse, verse 32, Jesus says, "For all these things the Gentiles eagerly seek, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these, but seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you." And here are the context. He's talking about physical concerns that we might have. And Jesus reassures us, God knows what you need. And it is, in fact, reassuring to know God created us. He knows what we need. So He knows not only what we need, He knows what is best for us. And He provides what we need even when, or perhaps even especially when, it's not what we ourselves think that we need. So, if we think about that, how can we apply that in our own parenting? I think over here, it's the same kind of idea. We have to know what our children need, which means we've got to pay attention. Right now, so as our children grow and mature, right, they have different needs that occur throughout their kind of life cycle, right? Starts off with what? Starts off with physical needs, which maybe are the easiest to understand. But then what other kind of needs do children have beyond physical needs? Think about as they grow and mature. Right. Emotional needs. Right, spiritual. Maybe behavioral. We could add social to the list. That might cover a pretty wide landscape of needs there. And I think it's clear that as the kids grow, they start off with physical needs, but then they pretty quickly get into some of these other needs. And it's important then to know what those needs are and to recognize when the needs are changing as they are maturing. Now, knowing their needs doesn't necessarily mean that, of course, we always give them what they want. It means, or even giving them, what it is that we want for them, right? Part of what children need is to know what they can't have, right? And understanding being told no from time to time. I think also with regard to behavioral needs, knowing what the rules are and knowing that they will in fact be enforced is important. They want to know, believe me, they want to know where are the boundaries and what will happen when those boundaries are crossed. So it logically flows then, I think, from getting back over to God. So He knows our needs, and the next thing then is that He provides us with our needs. Let's see. Let's take a look over back again in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 7. So Matthew chapter 7, beginning in verse 7, Jesus says, "Ask and it shall be given to you, seek and you shall find, knock and it shall be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it shall be opened. Or what man is there among you, when his son shall ask him for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if he shall ask for a fish, he will not give him a snake, will he? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him? Therefore, however you want people to treat you, so treat them, for this is the law and the prophets." So it's important, I think, as we go through this and understand that God knows what our needs are, and He provides us with these needs. But notice specifically what Jesus says there about what it is that God provides us. What does the text there indicate? What does Jesus say about what it is that God is able to give us?
What is good?
Right. So, not only knowing what our needs are and providing our needs, but He knows what is good. Now let's take a look at a couple, sort of take a sidetrack here, over to James for a moment. James chapter 1. James chapter 1 and verse 17. Every good thing bestowed, and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. And so God is, of course, He's the source of everything that is good. He knows what is good, and He knows how to give what is good. And we think back to the account of creation, especially in the latter days of the creation, every time God would create something, what would He say about it? It's good. God knows what is good. And finally, He's going to, you know, we have a promise from God that He will provide us what is good and what it is that we need. Take a look over in Philippians chapter 4, towards the end of Paul's letter here. He makes a number of very reassuring statements towards the end of this letter. Chapter 4 and verse 19, Paul writes, "And my God shall supply all your needs according to His riches in glory in Christ Jesus." And what's the supreme thing that God has given us? Salvation, right? Through what? Through the sacrifice of His Son, right? So part of providing our needs involves sacrifice. Now, if we think about that, what can we apply there to our own parenting? Again, we need to pay attention to what our kids' needs are. We need to provide them with their needs, paying attention to these, you know, different aspects or types of needs that our children will have from time to time. But how will we know? You know, how will we know what is good? Okay. Prayer, exactly. Prayer and, you know, study of God's Word, I think, is about the only way to come into that. So take a look. You know, we're already in Philippians, the fourth chapter. Take a look back, verses 8 and 9. "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence and if anything worthy of praise, let your mind dwell on these things. The things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace shall be with you." So take a look at this list, right? True, honorable, right, pure, lovely, of good reputation, excellent, worthy of praise. If we allow those concepts to really be our guide in understanding what is good, then we can really avoid a lot of debate with our kids, especially as they get older. So instead of debating whether something is relatively better or relatively worse with regard to a form of entertainment or some activity, you can just simply ask the question, is it pure? Because if you think about pure, something has to be 100% pure. If it's less than 100% pure, it's no longer pure, right? It's impure. It's somehow polluted. So I think what Paul writes here, and there's other similar passages as well, hold up a very high standard for what is good. And I think if we can, you know, we can allow that to be our foundation, our bedrock. We can stand upon that, and we can know how to guide our children, especially as they're getting up into the ages where they are, you know, beginning to make some decisions on their own about activities to be engaged with, you know, places to go, people to be with, and so forth. All right. I think that was everything along those lines. So if we take a look then at some of the good things. Oh, one other point too. So sacrifice. What are some of the things that we would be called upon from time to time to sacrifice for our kids? Or are we called upon to sacrifice for our kids? Okay, time, right? So let's add, okay, so back up a second. Know what is good. Okay. Sacrifice. Right. And I think one of the biggest ones somebody mentioned is time. Okay. And, you know, that comes into play every day, right? How are we going to, we've got the same amount of time every day. We've got to budget it. We've got to use it. And, you know, the notion of sacrifice comes into play because you're going to actively and deliberately choose what is best for your children in parenting them. And there's only so much time in a day, right? So certainly time is something we may be, you know, called upon, are called upon from a, on a daily basis to sacrifice. What else? Money. Okay. And when I think about that one, it's not so much giving our kids money, because clearly that happens. and not to say that that's not a sacrifice. But I think, too, you make these deliberate choices about how you're going to go about earning your money. And, you know, we live in an expensive part of the country, but it is a deliberate choice that each family makes about whether they're going to live on one income, going to live on two incomes. I mean, these are deliberate choices that have to be made with regard to, you know, parenting and running the family. And they're not to be taken lightly. And they're probably, I don't know, there may not be a single more significant decision with regard to parenting than that one. Are you going to live on one income, or are you going to live on two incomes? Because it dramatically has an effect, a very dynamic effect, I've observed, at least, on different families. Now, every family is different, so not to say that there is necessarily a universal answer in all cases, but just recognize that that is a significant decision and one that does have significant impacts as well. All right. So then if we think about some of the good things, right, that God gives to us, all right, I think one of the ones that we see from God is protection. And what is it that God protects us from? What or who? Okay, yeah, Satan, right? Protects us from Satan. Okay, and we can think of a couple of passages there. There's 1 Peter 5:8, right? Satan is prowling about like a lion seeking who he can destroy, right? So Satan is actively engaged in assaulting us. Paul describes over in Ephesians the armor that we are called upon, that we have available to us to wear against the fiery darts of Satan. So Satan clearly is actively out as a threat against us. And so if we model that same kind of protection, we'll say protect from threats to our kids as a part of loving our children, what are some of the threats against which we should be protecting our kids? What are some of those threats? It's easy to think about physical threats, right? We would pretty easily recognize those and stand. But what are some of the more insidious types of influences that threaten the spiritual well-being of our children? Okay. Right. Peer pressure. Okay. What else? There's a bunch. Culture. Okay. Yeah. That's a big one, right? Things that are politically correct but morally wrong, or socially acceptable but morally wrong. We need to protect the way that our kids think about those things, because clearly if they go to school or in other, you know, social settings, they're going to get a very different message in a lot of cases from what they should be getting. What else? Okay. Yeah. Maybe put that on worldly wisdom. Worldly wisdom. Okay. How about just plain old worldliness? Or we could call it greed. Okay.
Wait. Our own bad examples.
Okay.
Hypocrisy in our own mind.
Yeah, okay. Ourselves. Put that on there. Okay. Good point. I think, too, and we could probably spend all day on this, apathy is something against which we need to protect our kids, because we don't, you know, we don't want them to become complacent. We don't want them to be unenthusiastic, certainly when it comes to matters of serving others, serving the Lord. You know, if Christians are to be people zealous of good works, well, apathy really doesn't fit into that mindset or into that example. We'll just put here sins of the tongue, right? And what might be one that kids might be prone to, especially as they get into maybe adolescent years? I mean, lying is always something to protect them, teach them against. But what else? Okay, yeah. So disrespect. Disrespect. And I think, I think gossip is something that can be, you know, particularly hurtful and insidious. And when we think about that, right, it's not just oral communication. We have to think about technology. We have to think about how they are using Facebook, and we have to think about things I don't even know about, like Twitter, and, you know, all these different technologies now that our parents never had to think about how we were interacting and communicating with others, because it was either in person or it was over the phone. Maybe we wrote a letter once in a while. But, you know, texting is, that's how they communicate. I can, you know, before, so each of my kids, as they've matured, right, they go through a stage where they have a cell phone with a limited number of texts, and then it always hits me with one of them 1 month where it's like, you sent 5,000 text messages in 1 month? And then that's when they move from the limited to the unlimited. That is something, you know, if your kids are on Facebook, you better be on it as well to check out not only what, you know, to check out who their friends are, what's being written on their page, because, you know, in a lot of cases, kids are not, they haven't developed that maturity yet to really understand what's appropriate, what's inappropriate, and it's a teaching opportunity for certain. And it is, you know, it's important too that they learn how to use the tool, because it's an important social tool. Mike? Right. That's a really important point. You want to get them to a place, right, where they can then make the right decisions and they make the right choices. And so part of protecting them, you know, the ultimate goal of protecting them is getting them to that place where they can make the right decisions, despite the peer pressure and despite the culture they're exposed to and all that. And I think a big part of that is allowing them to make decisions and allowing them to fail from time to time, but allowing them to fail in a way that there's a bit of a safety net or guardrails, at least, that you've put in place. And, you know, let them not do their homework sometime and experience the consequence. But let them do that in second or third grade versus, you know, 11th or 12th grade, right? Right. exactly right. And we can't leave this point without talking about the importance of prayer. That is critically important in protecting our kids from, and ourselves as well, from evil influences. All right. So if we move on, then we've got a few minutes left. So we'll try to get through a couple more of these. God disciplines us. And I know that there's a whole separate section that's planned. I think Tony's teaching it on discipline. So not to get into all the different forms and reasons and methods of discipline and so forth, but I think just to make the point that discipline is an act of love, similar to the point that you were just making, Liz. It is an act of love. It is something that clearly God does to us and for us, and there's a connection between discipline and teaching. And so clearly, you know, disciplining our kids is something that we provide to them as well. We provide them with discipline. And I think it's important when we think about discipline and teaching that you really cannot not teach your kids. You're going to teach them one way or the other. The choice is, are you going to teach them, you know, what's right, or are you going to teach them, you know, what's wrong? There's no middle fence. There's no neutral ground. And so it's important that, you know, we are actively engaged in this in order to teach them, you know, what is right, what is wrong, the importance of, you know, respecting authority and obedience to God and to the truth of His Word. And I thought I saw your hand. All right. And then one other point here is that God keeps His promises. Now, let's look at a couple of passages here just to highlight this and understand this a little bit more. Let's look over in Deuteronomy chapter 7. And we'll just start reading actually at verse 6. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for His own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. The Lord did not set His love on you nor choose you because you were more in number than any of the peoples, for you were the fewest of all the peoples. But because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which He swore to your forefathers, the Lord brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery and from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know, therefore, that the Lord your God, He is God, the faithful God, who keeps His covenant and His loving kindness to a thousandth generation with those who love Him and keep His commandments, but repays those who hate Him to their faces to destroy them. He will not delay with him who hates Him. He will repay him to his face. All right. So, clearly we understand from this and from other studies we've had that that God keeps His promises. And notice, too, that there's a connection here in this particular text between God's faithfulness and His power as well. He points out here the power in bringing the Israelites out of the land of Egypt. So what do we learn from that? For our parenting, it's important as well that we keep our promises. Now, when we have children, I think that we have both implicit promises, or we might use the word commitments, really, and explicit commitments. Right? Maybe the explicit ones are a little more easier to think about and understand. It's where we tell our kids, okay, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're not going to do this, not going to do that, we're going to give you this, whatever. Those are the explicit promises that we make from time to time. And it is important that we are true to those and that we fulfill and we keep those. What are some of the implicit promises that maybe go without saying, but that as parents, we've signed up, right? There's no going back. It's a point of no return. And what are some of the implicit promises then that we've made to our kids? Okay. Right.
Well, when we look at the world, though, you know, when we think about discipline, I think this goes back to way real quick, and I think this is a critical point. Single most
God, he has given us the example. He has set the example. We have the example of Christ how to behave.
Right.
We want to be good parents. We have to set the proper example. When we think about our implicit promises, one of the most implicit promises is that we will set a good example. That is where the world is failing the children.
Yep. Okay. So we promised to set an example implicitly. I think that's right. And we'll get in. Actually, you're jumping ahead of me with my next point. But well, we'll talk about that in a second. All right. What else? Okay. Okay. And it gets back to really in all regards, you know, seeking out what is best for them. And also, you know, with regard to explicit promises, I think there's a point there as well, and that gets to kind of what we were talking about here. You know, they've got needs, and part of their needs are these behavioral needs, and knowing where the boundaries are for what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, right? And strictness is a matter of, you know, establishing where those boundaries are, and then making sure that those, you know, you are true to your promises of what the consequence will be when those boundaries are crossed. And so strictness is not a matter of how consistently you enforce the boundaries. Strictness is a matter of where the boundaries are, right? So are the boundaries here or are they out here? But wherever they are, you know, we are to keep our promises just as God, you know, kept his promises with the Israelites. I think it's a model for us as well to keep our promises that we have made to our children. So it's not just all the good things that we promise that will come to our children. Well, punishment and discipline is a good thing as well. They may not see it that way. But that's important as well. All right. One final point then let's talk about from with regard to God and his love for us as his children. And maybe we could have started out with this one, but you know, he has made us in his image. And it's getting really hard for me to write down here. So he's made us in his image. Now, we might not necessarily think about that as an act of love. You know, if we look over in Genesis chapter 1, the account of creation, we're all familiar with this, verse 26, as God is proceeding through his creative activities here. Verse 26, then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all of the earth." Now, if we think about that, though, and if we look over in the New Testament in Ephesians chapter 1 and in a couple of words right before verse 5, but "In love he predestined us to adoption as sons through Jesus Christ to himself, according to the kind intention of his will, to the praise of the glory of his grace." And so we know that, you know, really even before creation, God had this plan in place. And so as he was executing creation, and in fact as he was making us in his image, love was involved there in that whole activity. And so Eric, you know, to your point and to points we've made earlier, you know, we are to provide a good example, right? Provide a good example. Let's take a look over at Ephesians. We're already there, so just flip over to Ephesians chapter 6. And this is in the, you know, in Paul's discourse or letter here, where he's addressing different relationships that people find themselves, and part of that is children and parents. And in verse 4, his instruction to fathers, "And fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord." And so we see a couple of things here. He's not necessarily just talking about example here, but there's this, you know, bringing up your children in the teaching and the correction. So there's a positive and a negative that Paul uses there with regard to raising our children. The teaching is the positive, teaching them what to do, and the correction or the discipline, different translations use different words, that's the negative. That's here's the consequence for doing what is wrong and showing them that. And one of the most powerful, we talked about over here that when God was creating us, and in fact when he was keeping his promises, he demonstrated his power in all of that. And one of the most powerful ways, really, that we have available to us in teaching is through our example. And, we cannot not influence our children through our example. And so, Eric, to the points you made, and Liz, to the good points that you've made as well, we can either really solidify the verbal teaching that we're doing with our kids from the Word of God about what is right and what is wrong, or we can completely unwind and destroy that. And with our own, Wade, to your point about protecting our kids from ourselves, with our own hypocrisy, apathy, disbelief, our own sin, we can completely unwind that. And so that's something too that we need to guard against, and just always be aware that we are living an example and having an influence on our kids each day. And so as we go through providing what they need, understanding what their needs are, and as they mature and go through their different stages of childhood, adolescence, and so forth, just being aware of the example that we're setting before them. So that was all the points I had prepared. We're just about out of time. Any other comments, though, or questions before we wrap up? Wow, everybody agrees? Nobody disagrees? Okay. All right. Well, thank you all very much.